You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, very interesting. Intrade, the Irish betting site, is saying 59% chance Mitt Romney is going to win Michigan tonight, 46% chance Rick Santorum is. Of course, the spread is for the House. I guess the overlap, whatever, however it works. But if you're following Irish betting sites, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, don't forget, starting March 12th, you will hear me, this show, live 3 to 6 p.m. rather than noon to 3, where we are right now. And that would be noon to 3 p.m. Pacific time rather than 9 to noon Pacific time. We are moving March 12th. Russ Russell is on the line with us with ForgottenHarvest.org. I saw this incredible headline. I believe it was over at Democratic Underground, and although it's been all over the place, and it was just the headline was, "I'm not eating dinner tonight because it's my brother's turn," and it's the kind of thing that just stops you in your tracks. I guess Janelle Ross wrote about this over at Huffington Post, and Russ Russell, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you today, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You are the Chief Development Officer for Forgotten Harvest, the website ForgottenHarvest.org. First of all, very, very quickly, for our listeners who are unfamiliar with Forgotten Harvest, who are you folks? What do you do?
We're the nation's largest food rescue organization, and we rescue food that's perishable in nature, and we deliver it usually same day to over 200 agencies throughout Metro Detroit. And if you've heard anything about Detroit at all, hunger is the number one issue in our community that many children and elderly and families and homeless face every single day.
I mean, you look at the old Sally Struthers ads and you think hunger is something that happens in Africa, or so hunger was something that happened in China in the 60s. Hunger is something that happens in obscure villages in South America. Hunger in Detroit?
That's right. And, you know, Detroit sometimes, in my mind, because I've been able to travel 17, 18 different countries and work amongst the poor and with them and alongside them. And I've never seen hunger and poverty until I came to Detroit that had some similarities. I just want to preface that, some similarities. You don't see the kids with the bloated bellies, but you do see kids that are malnourished. Kids, you know, when you see a child that's obese, typically it's because they're not getting a well-rounded
diet. That's malnutrition.
The fruits, the vegetables, the meats, and the dairy items that these kids need. And so you'll see an obese child, but unfortunately that child is malnourished.
Yeah, that's malnutrition. Tell me the story of this young child you met.
Well, you know, we see so many different kids, and we are working on a project to really kind of show the different faces of hunger and their stories. And even though this one particular story, you know, is not going to be on this documentary that we're working on, because the mother just doesn't want to have the child, you know,
on camera
interviewed on this. But it's not unusual for children to have to skip meals, and it typically happens on the weekends here. You know, where kids just don't have access to the free lunch program
at school,
but during the summertime as well, and weekends, summertime, long period, break times, you name it. Children, unfortunately, in Detroit, 67% of these kids now live in very, impoverished areas inside of Detroit. And we're doing everything we can to get more food to them. In fact, we've increased from 12 million meals just a few years ago to probably around 36 to 40 million this year.
Incredible. Is this an actual quote? I'm not eating dinner tonight because it's my brother's turn tonight?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this was one of the young people that you met.
Well, it's
how old was this child?
A lot of people, you know, that's a good question. He's under 10, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, he was a youngster.
Now, you know, Lyndon Johnson with the Great Society program cut poverty in half in the United States in a little less than 6 years, and created this the platform on which enormous numbers of people whether it be poor white people in Appalachia or poor African Americans in inner cities, lifted themselves out of poverty and formed the basis of, in large part, of the establishment of the first generation of African American middle class and middle class coming out of poor areas that had traditionally just been multi-generationally impoverished. The destruction of that Great Society program began under the Reagan administration, and Bill Clinton said he'd ended poverty as we know it. All those kind of things sounded really fine when we had a balanced budget and the economy was booming and there were lots and lots of jobs. But isn't the social safety net here not just for structural poverty, but also for the kind of poverty that is cyclical, that comes with the business cycle, it comes with these kind of crashes, and we have now largely shredded that safety net, that social safety net?
Well, you know, the one thing, you know, we need to stop vilifying the poor and really focus on poverty. And you know, it sickens me to hear reports and different things, you know, about the food stamps and other things, you know, when there are so many people in need. And in Michigan, you know, to say the least, you know, we lost over 1 million manufacturing jobs. And those jobs, you know, are good. They're good people, hardworking people, but have fell on hard times. And the other statistic here locally that really goes, unoticed, but 21 or 22% of the population is underemployed. And what that means is that people are working two or three different jobs part-time. They don't get the health care. They don't get the other benefits that go with being a full-time employee. And they're struggling, but they're not lazy. They are working hard, and they're trying to make ends meet. And the other problem inside Detroit is that we have a major transportation problem. The public transportation system, you know, doesn't go 24 hours, doesn't go into certain parts of the suburban community. And where the jobs are, it's just simply very difficult to get to where those places are.
So people can't get to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a vicious cycle. If you don't own a car, you can't get to work, and you can't own a car without having a job. And so round and round it goes. How do we break this? How do we break this cycle of poverty?
Jobs is the healer of all things.
Yeah, that was Franklin Roosevelt's famous comment. He said the best welfare program in the world is a job. So to that extent, I mean, you guys are just dealing with food. You're not dealing with whether our trade policies are crazy or not, things like that. But
no,
you know,
I mean, we're up to our eyelids just, you know, keeping the agencies that we serve, because their numbers have just increased so dramatically.
How do you respond? We have a little less than a minute, Russ. How do you respond to the old Reagan welfare queen thing, that there are some people who just love being on welfare?
You know, I just totally discount that. You know, there might be one or two out there that, you know, might be, you know, scamming the system, I guess, so to speak. But but many of these, you know, unfortunate people that are on welfare have children.
Yeah.
And these children are the innocent ones. So whether you agree with it or disagree with it, you know, the bottom line is, you know, kids are going hungry. Mm-hmm. And we need to step up and take care of the least of these within our communities.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is what makes a strong community.
Yeah. The least of these, paraphrasing Jesus in Matthew 25. I would say that our welfare system now is so penurious. It is so tight. It is so... You have to live at such a low standard of living if you're living on welfare that the only kind of person who would say this is the lifestyle that I choose, that I want to have, would have to be somebody who is mentally ill.
And food stamps only last about, you know, 12, 13, 14 days for a family.
For a month.
They don't last a whole month.
Yeah, amazing. Stick around just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Russ Russell, ForgottenHarvest.org. Check out the website, ForgottenHarvest.org. Thanks, Russ.
Hello, Detroit auto worker. Let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just send it on down the line.
All eyes are on Michigan today for a critical primary in the Republican presidential race. The polls are showing a dead heat between Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum. One poll shows Rick up a point. One poll shows Mitt up a point. Arizona's also holding a primary. Mitt's in all probability going to win that. Between his campaigning there, he's got a good structure, and there's a lot of Mormons in Arizona. But Michigan is a crucial contest. Mitt Romney's the native son. He's getting hammered because back in 2008, he wrote that op-ed titled, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt Against the Auto Bailout. Santorum has jumped on this. Santorum is now robocalling Democrats, registered Democrats, the Santorum campaign. Here's what it sounds like. Here is the call that Michigan Democrats got yesterday, and I want to tell you, particularly those of you who are listening to me right now on the various radio stations that carry us in the state of Michigan, and there are several, or on Sirius XM, or on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, on DirecTV, on the web, however you may be listening to this show. If you live in Michigan, you need to listen to this guy. And frankly, anywhere in the country where there are open primaries, Massachusetts has an open, semi-open primary. You have to be registered as an independent to vote in the Massachusetts, you know, to be able to vote for either party. In Michigan, you can be a registered Democrat and vote as a Republican. And that's why Rick Santorum is running this robocall to Democrats all across the state.
Romney supported the bailouts for his Wall Street billionaire buddies, but opposed the auto bailouts. On Tuesday, join Democrats who are going to send a loud message to Massachusetts' Mitt Romney by voting for Rick Santorum for president.
And it goes on to say at the very end, this is a message brought to you from Michigan Democrats and paid for by the Santorum for President Committee. And that's a really important piece of that. All right, this is Rick Santorum officially telling Democrats to vote for him in the Republican primary. Now, this is a perfectly legal tactic in Michigan. And this is incredible. Now, Romney is upset about this. He's complaining about it. But on the other hand, here's Mitt Romney bragging a few months ago about how, in one of the debates, actually, about how he, as a Republican in Massachusetts, used to vote in the Democratic primary so that he could mess with Ted Kennedy. Here you go.
And in my state of Massachusetts, you could register as an independent and go vote in which either primary happens to be very interesting. And any chance I got to vote against Bill Clinton or Ted Kennedy, I took.
When there was no real contest in the Republican primary, I'd vote in the Democrat primary, vote for the person who I thought would be the weakest opponent for a Republican. I'd go in their primary, just like a lot of other folks, and voted against the person who I thought was the strongest Democrat. So, yeah, as an independent, I'll go in and play in their primary. But I'm a Republican and have been throughout my life, but a registered independent so I could vote in the primary.
So that's Mitt Romney talking about how he did this, what Rick Santorum is asking Democrats to do. Here's Mitt Romney today saying this is a bad thing to do.
It's outrageous to see Rick Santorum team up with the Obama people and go out after union labor in Detroit and try and get them to vote against me. Look, we don't want Democrats deciding who our nominee is going to be.
Although when he was a Republican, he wanted to decide who the Democratic nominee is. But anyhow, here's the point that I want to make, which has nothing to do with the gotchas here that I just shared with you. And that is that if you are in Michigan, I would strongly suggest that you either not vote in the Republican primary, leave it up to the Republicans, let it be an honest election. Or if you are going to vote, vote for Mitt Romney. Because here's my logic. There's no way Ricky Santorum is going to be the Republican nominee for president. No way. Ain't going to happen. He doesn't have the backing of Karl Rove. He doesn't have the backing of the Republican establishment. He is the outsider candidate. It's just not going to happen. He doesn't have enough of an organization in enough states. He doesn't have enough. He's only got one billionaire behind him. Mitt Romney's got 10 billionaires behind him. You know, the odds are one of two things is going to happen. Either Mitt Romney's going to be the candidate, in which case it's very likely that Barack Obama will win the election. Because Mitt Romney is a deeply flawed candidate. Or if Michigan Democrats think they're going to be too cute by half and do what Ricky Santorum is asking them to do with these robocalls, and they go in and they vote in the Republican primary, Michigan Democrats, if you vote in the Republican primary for Santorum thinking this is your way of whacking Romney, you may whack Romney to the point that there's a brokered convention and you end up with neither Romney nor Santorum, but instead you end up with a Chris Christie Marco Rubio ticket, which actually has a serious chance of beating President Obama, or a Jeb Bush Marco Rubio ticket, or a Marco Rubio Chris Christie ticket, or a Marco Rubio, fill in the blanks, Marco Rubio Mitch Daniels ticket. Any of those tickets have a stronger chance of beating President Obama than a Mitt Romney fill in the blank ticket does. Now, granted, if Mitt Romney takes Rubio as his running mate, it's going to get him a lot of mojo and it's going to make him harder to beat. But the fact of the matter is that Santorum is not the Republican Party is not going to allow a crazy man like Rick Santorum to be their nominee. It just isn't going to happen. And so the choice is between Mitt Romney or somebody who's so much stronger than Romney that they're looking at Obama right now and they're saying, you know, it's going to be a hell of a job to beat this guy. I don't want to be in the race. Or somebody like Chris Christie, who, if he had been in these primaries, wouldn't have been able to win any of the debates because he's not quite that crazy. And he's not willing to pretend he is like Romney. So my advice, and I realize this is the complete opposite of what a lot of people are, you know, giggling and rubbing their hands about. I think that that is, you know, that may be cute checkers. Hey, let's beat Michigan. It's lousy chess. Three moves down, we're going to lose. Or we're going to be in real trouble. So I would say to my friends in Michigan, my family in Michigan, I grew up in Michigan, and I know the trees are the right height compared to them damn redwoods out in California where Romney's got his mansion. I would say to my friends in Michigan, let the Republicans have their primary. Stay out of it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's interesting. Alan in Huntington Beach says he disagrees we should vote Santorum. We'll have a conversation with him right after this. Stick around.
Michigan, where the trees are right. Perfect color, perfect height. The sky is blue and the water's wet. Michigan's the best state yet. Oh, Michigan, I hope to win. This is the state I started in. My dad would be so proud of me. Trashing the auto industry.
Jim Turris is absolutely brilliant. Welcome back. Oh, by the way, a quick announcement. This week, I should have mentioned this yesterday. This week only in Manhattan for those. Oh, is it next week? Yeah, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. It's March 2nd through the 8th. Oh, today's February 28th. Okay, so it's next week. Next week only. Thank you, Louise. Next week, March 2nd through the 8th, the 1 week only, New York's Quad Cinema, 34 East, West 13th Street, New York City. It's the movie called Heist. Heist the movie. Right. In fact, the website is heist-themovie.com. And featuring Bernie Sanders, Robert Kuttner, David K. Johnston, Nomi Prinz, Van Jones, and narrated by some wackadoodle by the name of Tom Hartman. And so this is a truly brilliant documentary on how the banksters robbed us and how it really wasn't just the banksters robbed us during the Bush administration, how really it started in a big way about 40 years ago with a very serious, a small group of people with a very serious plan and how they laid it out, how they put it together, and how they executed it. And it's an amazing movie. You can get tickets and information over at heist-themovie.com. And as I said, 1 week only, March 2nd through the 8th, which is next week. And that's at New York City's Quad Cinema, 34 West 13th Street. All that said, as I mentioned, Alan, you want to disagree with me? Hey, thanks for watching us there in Huntington Beach, California. What's on your mind, Alan?
Hey, Tom, how are you? Listen, I never disagree with you, Tom, but on this, I think we should get out there and vote for Rick Santorum, and here's why. There isn't a person, especially Chris Christie, that can beat President Obama. Chris Christie had a chance for same-sex marriages, and he wanted a referendum on it. He wasn't strong enough to make that decision. You have Mitch Daniels, who are trying to break the unions. If they get one of these guys to come in and take over, which they probably would, right? Mm. Barack Obama will beat them. Would you want to go up against a guy like Barack Obama? And if we do that, we will weaken them for 2016. For me, it's all about strategy. I say bring them on. I say get Rick Santorum so we can get him in there and the president can shut him down, or Mitt Romney, whichever it is.
Yeah.
They're not strong enough to beat this guy. And this just shows that people are more powerful than money. This will start something.
Well, we will see. I mean, you know, if the people are more powerful than money, then you definitely want Mitt Romney because he's the guy who's got all the money. But, you know, I think that, you know, and I'm willing to have my mind changed on this. Alan, thank you for your comments. Thanks for your comments. And let me share with you some from the chat room, and then I'm going to – our lines are get slammed here. I'll pick up some more of yours. But just first of all, Merwina said when we were talking about welfare in the first segment, she says, oh, some people do love being on welfare, corporate welfare. Just ask GE, ExxonMobil, Shell, or any bankster. Forgot about that. Sorry, Merwina. You're absolutely right. Brandini points out we don't register in, by party in Michigan. Right. That I think that was my point. Carprog says, I disagree with Tom. Make the Repugs, as in Republicans, spend a lot of money in the primaries and tear each other up. Well, that's happening. Benedict makes a really interesting point. Jeb and Marco can't run together because they're both from Florida. Mitt and Marco Rubio, can't run together because they're both Mormons. Now, Marco Rubio was only a Mormon from the time he was 8 until he was 12, and then he went back to Catholicism. And that was a recent revelation. But I think it is going to make it more difficult for him to be on a ticket with Mitt Romney because it's going to heighten the whole Mormon issue, which is blowing up in their face with regard to the evangelical vote. So we'll see. By the way, I just noticed I was looking at Intrade. Intrade is this Irish betting site, and I always find it fascinating because Intrade is where people are actually putting their money where their mouth is. And from the time we started this show at noon Eastern time until now, it's about 39 minutes, the Intrade numbers on Romney, in fact, I should check it again as we talk here, the Intrade numbers on Romney winning the state of Michigan. At noon, it was 59%. Right now, it's 54%. So he's lost 5 points in 39 minutes. That's not a good sign, right? That's not a real good sign. Michael in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, I was just listening to the break, and they were talking about how Romney's 2008 comments about Detroit were being brought up.
Yeah.
I heard you on the radio last week, and you had a guest on there talking about how Obama was bringing up something what Obama said back in 2008 about the oil industry, and you said, how dare he bring up 2008, which was 4 years ago. Now, do you still feel the same way about what Romney said about Detroit back in 2008?
Michael, I genuinely, and I'm sorry. I mean, you know, if you want to argue with me and fight with me, I usually like to do that. But I genuinely have no idea what you're talking about.
You were there with Steve.
Are you talking about my debate with Steve Malzberg?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he brought up that back in 2008 where Obama was...
My objection to Steve wasn't that he was quoting Obama from 2008. Was that my objection was that he was quoting him wildly out of context, he was changing the meaning. I don't think that I'm changing the meaning when I play a clip of Mitt Romney in the debates bragging about the fact that he voted in the Democratic primaries in Massachusetts whenever he had a chance. His phrase in order to mess with Actually, Jacob, just, you know, play the clip again here.
And in my state of Massachusetts, you could register as an independent and go vote in which either primary happens to be very interesting. And any chance I got to vote against Bill Clinton or Ted Kennedy, I took.
So I don't think that that's out of context. That's a night and day disagreement here. Alan, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I wouldn't write off the Hispanic community as being that gullible by putting Marco Rubio on.
Well, I'm not suggesting gullible. I do think, however, that people tend, you know, people who are on the fringes, people who are on the margins with regard to their political acuity, people who are just, you know, not really following politics, will tend to vote for, you know, I think a lot of Catholics came out and voted for Jack Kennedy because he was Catholic. There were a lot of African Americans who came out and voted for Barack Obama because he was African American. There were a lot of evangelicals, actually. In fact, if you go back and you look at the 1976 election, there were the one of the things that helped, in fact, probably the major thing that helped Jimmy Carter beat Jerry Ford was that he had the evangelical vote with him. It was the last time that the evangelical vote strongly went for a Democratic candidate because Jimmy Carter had come out and said he was a born-again Christian, and he was.
But the immigration policies for the Republicans is miserable, and the Hispanics know it.
Well, they do, here's the other thing. A lot of, the Hispanic population in the United States is largely Catholic, and one of the things that's flying under the radar is that there is a multi-million dollar effort to what's called LMA, which is a license management agreement, I think it is, or something like that, which is where you basically rent a radio station for a year. And there are several groups that are involved in this, and we're still trying to figure out where all the money's coming from. But it's a multi-million dollar effort, and they are LMAing stations, radio stations, in all the major markets in America. And they're putting right-wing Spanish-language talk show hosts on, and they are pushing the Republican agenda hard in Spanish on these stations. And it's totally flying under the radar because, you know, most of the people in the media don't speak Spanish, don't even know that it's going on. And you would be astounded when you look at the numbers of the number of Hispanics in the United States who are starting to self-describe themselves as Republican as a result of this major push that's been going on for about a year now and is going to run right up to the election. These are like two-year rentals of these radio stations with Hispanic radio. So, Alan, you know, I on either side, I don't think that we should take anybody's vote for granted just because of their ancestry. But I'll tell you, the Republicans are pushing really hard to get the Latino vote and the Hispanic vote, and I wouldn't take, and just because the Republican immigration policies stink, I wouldn't take it for granted. I don't want to go there. So Helen in Ithaca, New York, listening on 1470 AM. Hey Helen, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
I just have kind of a duh question, sort of, because we were talking about who could possibly, you know, become the nominee, if not
right.
The two we're discussing, and someone said, you know, Jeb Bush. And, you know, Mike Papantonio, he's a personal injury attorney.
Yeah, I know. Mike is a friend of mine. I know him. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, so he was on just Sunday evening, and he said, he was very adamant about this. He said, ha-ha, there's no way, and I like him, you know, I never met him, but he's like, there's no way Jeb Bush would ever become the nominee. He's like, he's got so much dirty laundry and skeletons in his closet, it's impossible.
I have heard that as well, and let me tell you, do you think that a Republican who has admitted to snorting cocaine, who has been accused of wife beating, had the police called on him for it, who not only dodged the draft but went AWOL for a full year and spent most of that year in a drunken stupor. Do you think such a person could run for president? That was George W. Bush, and he actually became president. I mean, it took the Supreme Court to appoint him, but so I think even with skeletons in Jeb Bush's closet, he represents a significant threat if he's got a lot of money behind him. Helen, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And isn't it amazing how once the mainstream, you know, once George W. Bush was anointed the candidate, the mainstream media just stopped talking about the skeletons in his closet. Weird. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Beth in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Beth, what's up?
Hi. Well, I have a comment and a plea. But with all the shenanigans that are going on with the Rick Santorum and elect him so that, you know, all that kind of stuff's going on, I feel like the main issue still in the election is voter suppression. And all of that that's going on across the country.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you feel like about that. But I also have a plea. I cannot afford your show except to turn on the radio. That's my only access to you. I live on the West Coast. The only time I can listen to you is from 9 in the morning as I prepare for work and drive 45 minutes to work.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to be slipping into a black hole of non-information because, to me, you are the best teacher I've ever had in history, civics, public affairs, all of that. I don't know if this time changes your choice or if there's a radio god I can plead to.
No, it is to a large extent not my choice, and or well, to some extent, but it's there are. You know, I can't go through the whole explanation. It is something that has to happen, and it's not going to change. We are on March 12th going to move our show back 3 hours from on the West Coast from nine to noon until noon to three. And you know, there are other options. There are web options. And most of our radio stations are going to just move the show back. So, Beth, thank you for your call. And thank you for your kind words. Will in Humboldt, California, listening on AM 1480. Hey, Will, what's up?
Yeah, Will? Hi, Tom.
Yeah, on the air.
Yeah, hi. Something I've been meaning to call you about for a few days here. I noticed here recently when that FAA funding authorization bill passed that eviscerated the collective bargaining rights of airlines workers and railroad workers, by the way, one of the first unionized group of employees in the country, and also allowed military-grade drones weighing no more than 2 kilos to be used for used by local police departments.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequently, shortly after that, and that bill was passed basically in the dead of night, and our two senators here in California voted for it, which I called them up and recorded castigating messages, which whatever good that did. But then anyway, subsequently after that, the president's bill, the bill that he was promoting, the payroll tax holiday and all the other things attendant with that passed. That looked like a quid pro quo to me.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I'll take your answer off the air.
Sure. I think that there are a lot of quid pro quos in politics. It's kind of the essential nature of politics, and it may well be. I don't know the details, the backroom details of that. And most, frankly, on most of these kind of deals, I don't think that we ever will. Dan in Troy, Montana. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Well, here in Montana, we had a billion-dollar grain crop,
mm-hmm.
and $133 million of subsidies grew it. That's all our grains.
Right.
And then our children are starving. And Schweitzer the other day in the Missoulian said, well, we ship all our grain wealth out of the state, and it's about time that we started feeding our people, especially our poor, starving children.
Hmm.
I thought, what an outrage.
Yeah.
All this wealth goes to the oligarchy.
Yeah. No,
people starve.
You're right. And it is astounding that in America you have 10 million children who live with what's called food insecurity. In other words, they don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And and we also have, you know, 100 of the Fortune 500 Fortune 400 wealthiest individuals in America. Those 400 individuals, by the way, own more wealth than a third of all other Americans, and 100 of those 400 people pay no income taxes. It's absolutely mind-boggling. It's a crime. Then Dan, thank you very much for the call. Barbara in Belfast, Maine. Hey, is it Maine? Emmy?
Maine.
Maine. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
I was wondering, I thought I had read somewhere that they put together corporations allowing a bunch of companies to get together to do these large projects like Hoover Dam and thing,
mm-hmm.
and that it was a temporary kind of thing, you know, that they allowed them to incorporate so it was easier to build these
right.
things.
Prior to the 1880s, most corporations were, in fact, in every state in the Union, corporations couldn't live for more than 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on the state. And most corporations were created for individual projects. The Erie Canal, for example, was one. The railroads were
right.
others. And they were intended to be short-term projects. And then Standard Oil, John Rockefeller, and Andrew Carnegie with U.S. Steel, and the Mellon family with banking and whatnot, they basically pioneered this new form of corporation where they got the states to actually change their corporate charter laws so that they could do more than one thing. They could own other corporations, which used to be illegal. It used to be illegal for a corporation to buy another corporation. That they could be incorporated for longer than 20, 30, or 40 years, so they could accumulate wealth on an unlimited basis and become an empire. It used to be that every 30 or 40 years you had to reboot the corporation, basically pay an estate tax, and start over again. All of these things changed in this era between basically 1885 and 1895, when virtually every state changed their state charter laws in response to enormous pressure, largely from the Rockefellers, from John Rockefeller. And that era, in fact, when you talk to historians, I wrote, there's a chapter about this in my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People. And when you talk to historians, that era is referred to as the charter mongering era. And because,
oh goodness,
yeah, because the states were changing their charter, their corporate charter laws, the laws that defined how a corporation can exist within that state. There was this massive competition. John Rockefeller was in Ohio. Ohio declared what he was doing with the Standard Oil Trust to be an illegal monopoly and threatened to put him in jail if he didn't stop. And so what he said was, okay, Ohio's not going to put up with this. They're not going to change their laws. What state will change their corporate charter laws to make what I'm doing legal? And
is
New
that
Jersey.
When he moved to Northeast Harbor? Because I grew up on Mount Desert Island.
Yep, and that's
in Rockville Village.
Yep, and New Jersey changed their laws. New York changed their laws. Delaware changed their laws. Rhode Island changed their laws. All within a month of his saying that. And Delaware actually ended up with the least restrictive corporate laws, which is why half of all the New York Stock Exchange companies are incorporated in Delaware. But he moved to New Jersey.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And should we have toll roads? I don't know. Maybe we'll have a conversation about that. Oh, he is. Okay, cool. I guess we will have a conversation about that. Adrian Moore is with us. Adrian Moore, Ph.D., Vice President of Policy at the Reason Foundation, co-author of the book Mobility, or the, I don't know if it's a book or a policy statement, Mobility First, New Vision for Transportation in a Globally Competitive 21st Century. You can find it over at reason.org. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You are pitching toll roads. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's reasonably accurate.
Privatized toll roads?
I think some of them. If a road that you're building that's going to be tolled will generate enough revenue for the private sector to make the investment, that makes a lot of sense, because then the money that we have from the gasoline taxes and other things can go to roads that can't be tolled or can't be built by the private sector. And so it's a way of sort of dividing and conquering to make sure we get enough roads built.
So you're suggesting that we should turn our public roads over to corporations that typically, like in the health insurance industry, skim 30% off the top to pay their CEOs multimillion dollar salaries, to pay billions of dollars of money to their stockholders, to have, you know, corporate jets with gold faucets in the washrooms, things like that, that we should do that with the commons of our roads. I understand the libertarian vision of there being basically no commons, but can you describe to me any country other than Somalia that has done this? And in Somalia, of course, as you know, it's not corporations who have tolls along the roads. It's local warlords who have checkpoints where you have to pay, you know, bribes to get past. But it's effectively the same thing. Can you describe for me any country where this has ever been done successfully?
Yeah, all of the freeways in France are toll roads.
And they're owned by private corporations.
That crazy conservative place.
And they're owned by private corporations.
Yes.
That's pretty astounding.
Australia has an extensive network of private toll roads. The UK has a bigger network. France has the biggest network.
Yeah, France is
Germany,
also
Italy.
the lead of privatizing water. And not only their own, they've privatized, you know, the water of London, the Thames and things, although the British are starting to get pretty upset about this. It seems nuts to me. I mean, the French are also into nuclear power, which seems nuts. But isn't this really a 20th century debate when we should be having, and we're in the 21st century, instead of debating how we're going to do our roads and what corporations we're going to hand our roads off to so that they can make money off, you know, the average schlub trying to get to work, shouldn't we be talking about things like light rail and high-speed rail, things that the developing world is moving rapidly toward, China, India, Russia. All these countries are building high-speed rail and light rail systems that are very, very efficient and provide access for people to get to work.
Well, the things are not mutually exclusive, first of all. And as we grow, our populations grow, our cities grow, you have to have transportation infrastructure to get people from here to there. We've got to be able to be mobile in our cities. You know, you mentioned my book. The whole premise of the book is that people've got to be able to get anywhere within a city within a reasonable time in order for them to function economically and socially.
Right.
So you need a transportation system that does that. Now, developing countries are, like you say, embracing rail transit increasingly. Interestingly, developed countries, so again, going back and looking at Europe, which built out their rail transit systems extensively after World War II and have very dense cities compared to the U.S., they're shifting away from transit to roads. The percentage of people who use public transit in Europe is declining each year as more and more people drive. The U.S. is already there. We sort of started that way after World War II. So,
you know,
we have with rail transit in the U.S. is that nobody uses it.
Well, actually, a lot of people use it in the dense areas like the Northeast Corridor, in the Pacific Southwest. There's a lot of places where it could work really well. I have traveled around France. It just suddenly occurred to me. I've driven French roads. I've taken the French train too. The LBT.
Yeah, I've used the high speed train there and everything.
Yeah, and that train is amazing. I mean, you know, a couple hundred miles an hour just zipping across the countryside. I don't recall ever having seen a toll road in France. You said they're extensive. What percentage of the French highways are privately owned toll roads?
The entire equivalent of the Autobahn network, so the inner city freeways there are tolled, and around 70% of them, as I recall from the last data, are private.
So what percentage of the total highway systems in the country of France are privatized and toll roads?
Yeah, now that I don't know, because I don't know how they count their...
Because what you just described is a slice of a slice. I know that there's in Atlanta, they allowed a private company to come in and build a toll road when we were living there. And so you could say, okay, you know, 5% of Atlanta's roads are, but that's not the United States. So,
right.
So you don't have that statistic.
No. Nationally, in the U.S., I do know that, I mean, one interesting statistic, I guess, and this isn't necessarily to do with private toll roads, but in the last 10 years, one-third of the new freeway capacity that we've built in the United States has been tolled. Now, much of that was tolled by government, not through a public-private partnership,
sure.
and a lot of it was public.
And a lot of this is because the gas tax was fixed at 18 cents, as I recall, not 18%. And so as the price of gasoline goes up and the use of gasoline goes down, the gas tax is producing less and less revenue.
That is just the federal gasoline tax. The states have their own.
Whether your comment that Europeans are moving to cars and away from rail is accurate or not, it's not what I've seen when I get over there several times a year. What I see is trains that are absolutely packed to the gills, and high speed trains and radically improving trains. There are a lot of people on the highways, but nonetheless. Do we really want to be driving on roads that are owned by a corporation that's skimming 30% off the top?
Well, Tom, I mean,
that's owned by David and Charles Koch.
I think about your day-to-day life. Are the things that work best in your day-to-day life the things provided by those evil private corporations, or the things provided by government?
The things that work best are having
day-to-day consumption is provided by our TVs, provided by corporations, radio is provided by corporations, our computers we're talking on.
I don't think those things are the commons, but the internet was created by the government. You and I, however anybody is hearing us or seeing us, whether they're watching us on satellite TV or whether they're listening to a radio station or whatever, and our own personal communication is all going over the commons. It's all being, you know, whether it's ISDN lines, telephone lines, satellite lines, whatever. It's all, you know, part of the commons created by government.
Tom, none of those things are commons. They're all privately owned networks.
No, they're not. The airwaves
are
not privately owned. They are the property of all of us. They are leased.
No, they're leased. Well, none of these roads are privatized either. They're all concessions. So the government retains ownership, and the private sector operates them on a long-term lease, exactly like the spectrum. You could look at that as still being government-owned and privately operated, or you could look at it as a temporary property right.
I'm just very concerned about the loss of the commons here. And Adrian, and I get it that, you know, the Reason Foundation and the libertarians, you know, associated with it don't basically believe in the commons. You guys think that, you know, billionaires and giant corporations should own everything and we should, you know, be their wage slaves, I suppose. But I'm very concerned that if we start handing our roads over to corporations, the day is going to come when they hit such a monopoly that it's like, you know, with television now, you get 200 channels and those 200 channels are owned by 8 companies. And you really genuinely don't have
rights. Everywhere we have private toll roads in the U.S., their popularity is very high. We've done a lot of surveys on this.
Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That would have to be because they're putting toll roads in those places where they know that there's a lot of demand, and that's where they can make the money. But anyhow, Adrian Moore, reason.org. You can read all about it. Adrian, thanks.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
Well, how would you feel if to get on the road you had to pay a toll to a corporation to get to work every day? Victoria in Cuba, New Mexico. Hey, Victoria. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that I admire you very much for what you do.
Thank you.
The point I wanted to make, and then I'll hang up, is that I lived in France for 15 to 20 years, and Mr. Adrian Moore, who you interviewed, was very selective and, in fact, misleading in his comments regarding toll roads. It is true that there are toll roads for the main highways that go through France, but, in fact, they're supported by the public and highly regulated on the basis that there is a tremendous support for mass transit. There is not a town that you can go to in France that you can go to any town in France on the trains, and in fact there are alternative routes so that you do not have to go to the toll roads. The toll roads are mainly for high speed travel.
Right.
And it would not work in this country because we do not have the kind of mass transit which we should have had, which rather than so much travel by car.
So the toll roads work in France because A, people have the alternative of taking the train. B, they have the alternative of taking back roads, which are actually pretty good roads. And
it's a much smaller country.
Yes.
And because, but they have tremendous support, government support for mass transit in that country, as you know. You can
right.
go on the metros in Paris, trains to any little town in France, buses. It just is not practical. And in this country, it would limit the poor who would, you know, even the poor in this country have to buy cars and therefore and would not have the benefit of mass transportation that they
right.
is a common that could be shared with other citizens the way it is
right.
in France. So I thought he was very selective and misleading.
Well, that's why I, you know, when he first said, you know, they've got the toll roads all over the place, it's like, you know, they're
not all over the place.
They're
the main highways. It would
yeah.
be like the main interstates in this country, which in fact, as you
which
pointed
are toll
out
roads,
on your show before,
by and large.
Were paid for by citizens.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you know, I don't know how it is once you get west of Michigan, but when Louise and I, the 10 years Louise and I lived in Vermont, every year we would drive back to Michigan, sometimes a couple of times when my dad was real sick. And there are toll roads, you know, on I-80 there, across Ohio, my recollection is across Ohio, parts of Pennsylvania, what, you know, it's a toll road. And,
mm-hmm.
but it's owned by you know, the toll is used to maintain that highway and to pay for the rest areas and all that kind of stuff. I'm quite sure they're not owned by some private corporation, although...
No, that would be a disaster in this country because there's no regulation anymore on corporations in this country. As you've pointed out, it's I wanted to also say good work for your work on talking about Citizens United. I really appreciate that because it needs to be overturned.
Thank you, Victoria. I absolutely agree with you. And get over to Bernie Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and sign his constitutional amendment. It's a start, and I think he's going to have an even stronger version of it after the elections. Victoria, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Oh, and if you want to support Bernie Sanders, by the way, we don't talk about it when he's on the show, but I can talk about it when he's not. And that's his campaign website is Bernie.org. And that's where if you think that Bernie Sanders needs to stay in the United States Senate, get over to Bernie.org and help him out. Karen in La Canada, California, listening on K-Talk.
Hello.
Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the caller you had a couple of times ago talking about toll roads from the Reason Institute. You know, California has tons of highways and freeways.
Right.
And in Orange County, they built a couple of toll roads. One was operated by a private company, and it was 51 miles long. And then there was a second operated by an Orange County agency.
Right.
Both of them had severe declines in ridership during the recession from 2007 to 2011. And one of them, the private agency, filed for bankruptcy and tried to give the road system back to the state.
Wow.
So
okay.
I don't know where they're at right now.
Uh-huh.
I've only found a story that was 1 year old, but I used to ride that road when I'd go down to visit my sister. It cost $7 to ride that up and back. And it's a pretty drive, and it can cut your time by as much as 20 minutes. But a lot of people, you know, it's not all that congested down there.
Right.
The congestion they were expecting when they built the toll road didn't materialize.
Right, and a lot of people can't afford it. And I can understand something like, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge is a toll, right? But that, you know, it's very expensive to maintain a bridge like that. And and that money is going to whatever I don't know if it's the municipality of San Francisco or the county or the state, whoever maintains it, but that's basically to maintain the bridge. So, excellent point, Karen. Thank you very much for sharing your experience with us. Dwayne in Seattle. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
How you doing? And I want to ditto about you being courageous and fighting the good fight for all of us.
Oh, thank you. I'm doing my best. What's up?
Well, I was thinking, it's just an idea, but if we could build a Autobahn Free America type road, and I wouldn't mind the government putting a toll on it, but if we could build that with these archaic implements, I mean, get people picking shovels and get out there and have a living wage job.
Yeah.
You know, if it took 20 years to build.
Well, we've got an interstate highway system right now, Dwayne, across the United States. I think that what we don't have in this country, what Europe does have, what China just built, I mean, they just completed a 5,000-mile high-speed rail route that would be the equivalent of, you know, like from Chicago to New York City and beyond that. I mean, that's only 2,300 miles. They just completed this huge high-speed rail system that can get you the equivalent of from Chicago to New York in about 8 or 9 hours, which is incredible. I mean, you know, it's as the CSX ads love to point out, I think it's CSX, one of the big rail companies, they can move a ton of freight for 400 miles on a gallon of fuel. I mean, it's incredibly efficient once you get up to speed. And the engines, the modern locomotives, are actually hybrids. They run off battery. They're running off electricity, off electric motors and giant batteries. And then they got diesel engines to charge the batteries. And then when they slow down, they capture that momentum and use it to recharge the batteries. So it's incredibly efficient. So we need to be going that way. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll check in on where Mitt Romney is in the Michigan primary with Intrade.com in a minute, and back with your call.
They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank, fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up.
How would you feel if you had to pay tolls to corporations on the freeway to get to work every day and some CEO is getting fat off it, or, you know, Paris Hilton or Mitt Romney is sitting around the pool on their butt getting dividend checks from it? Because that's what happens, you know, when corporations take things over. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the airwaves. And Terry in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I think the problem here is that so many Americans just don't understand the history of America and how we grew, what made us strong economically, which was really a combination of, you know, capitalism and regulation and controlling all of this.
And government investment.
The comment I wanted to make about this toll road situation, The problem is you've got accountants making these decisions, and they don't understand this whole commons thing that you're talking about. It's something they can't put their fingers on. It would be like an accountant making a decision on NASA for the Apollo project. What would have happened is they would have scrapped it because they would have said, well, it's going to cost billions of dollars to go to the moon, and how much can we sell moon rocks for? That's how they think. They don't understand about the efficiencies, moving people around quickly, all of those different factors that they can't charge for.
Right. When you put high-speed rail
in
California, into... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, high-speed rail is a perfect example. We're having a big problem here in California. After it was already passed, they're still talking about, well, it's not going to be cost-effective and all this stuff. They just don't get it.
Yeah. What they don't get also is the impact on a community. I mean, even with a freeway, if you have an exit from a freeway, all of a sudden in the neighborhood where that exit is, all the property values go up. If you have a metro station or a subway station or a light rail station, wherever there's access to it, property values go up because people now have access to work, they have access to living. It improves the value, the overall wealth of the nation. You know, to paraphrase Adam Smith, you're absolutely right. The people are not looking at the intangibles. They're not looking at all the benefits of society, of people having that kind of mobility. And it's really important stuff to have that kind of mobility. Owen, listening on AM Talk 1090 in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Owen, what's up?
Oh, nice to be on you again. Just two really quick points. I grew up in Germany. I spent my first 20 years there, first half of my life. The toll roads in France are famous for one thing. All of the traffic that could be going through France is not clogging up their roads because everybody's bypassing these toll roads and going through those nice German highways that have no speed limit.
So people are going around France.
Oh, yes.
Instead of through France.
Big time. They're not
going of the toll
through
roads.
France. They're going around if they can avoid it in any way. The other point is Germany used to have a publicly owned federal railway system. It has now been partially privatized. It's really kind of an odd deal that I think very few people can really figure out. But prices went up. Local traffic is basically being blackmailed by this Deutsche Bahn Aktiengesellschaft, the German railway stock corporation, because they are still pulling in the subsidies but at the same time they're jacking up prices. They are still, don't get me wrong, they are far superior to anything that's here in the United States, but they are no longer maintaining the tracks they used to. So yeah. Anything that is still great about that system is still running on the now deteriorating foundation of the former glory of the federal railway system.
Right, and this is
riding on what the people built 20 years ago.
Right, and this is the classic model for privatization. Is a private corporation will go in and they'll say, we'll buy your airport and run it more efficiently. We'll buy your sewage plant and run it more efficiently. We'll buy your power plant and run it more efficiently. They buy it. They don't do any upgrades for a decade or two or very little maintenance. As the thing is falling apart, then at the end of the 20 years, when the four or five CEOs in a row have taken home tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, and the stockholders, you know, people like Mitt Romney and Paris Hilton have put a lot of money in their pockets, you know, just waiting for the dividends checks to arrive, paying a maximum 15% income tax. After that's all done and the thing is falling apart, then the company declares bankruptcy, as the caller pointed out earlier, happened in Washington State. And says, here, government, it's yours. We're going to give it back to you. We're going to go away. We've sucked
that's
this
right.
thing dry.
And that also plays into this misinformation that your guest gentleman put out there. Yes, it is true that more people are being forced into cars because of the increasing prices, because in a lot of situations you're actually cheaper off in the car.
Right.
But that is, it is no longer an actual fully federal system. It is no longer a people's own system. It is now a privatized system.
Has Deutsche Bahn been privatized?
As well as it could.
Has Deutsche Bahn?
Yes, that's. It is now the Deutsche Bahn Aktiengesellschaft. It's the
Aktiengesellschaft, a corporation.
Stock corporation, yes.
Stock corporation. Amazing. I had no idea.
That happened in the 90s already.
Wow. Okay. Owen, thank you very much for the information. It's amazing. You know, we get Americans on here saying, oh, here's how things are in France. Here's how things are in Germany. And then people who live in France and Germany call up and say, no, let me tell you how it really is.
And maybe just one more thing. I know time is limited, but many Germans are regretting all of these privatizations. And
oh, sure.
The privatized healthcare corporations are now facing crisis, and they are also the private health insurances. There's already talk that they might want to eliminate those.
Yeah, I know. There was a piece of the German system got the healthcare system. They allowed the private corporations in, and it's whacking them. So. Yeah, amazing story. Oh, and thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Alice in Springfield, Mass., listening on 1400 AM. Hey, Alice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Listen to you all the time. Here are my quick thoughts on if for-profit corporations own the roads. One is they could discontinue service and repair at will, whereas if I have a pothole on my road, I can call a local elected official and complain about it. They could also raise tolls at will. They could totally close down a highway or a road, especially if it was rural or not profitable enough. They could also sell rights to the use of the sides of the road. So that's my thought.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very well said. And it is absolutely one of the problems that you get with those kind of situations. Don in North Judson, Indiana. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, what's happening, Tom? I just thought I'd let you know that, you know, you've traveled on I-80. You said to go see your dad in Michigan. Well,
yeah, it was either 80 or 90. Yeah.
Right. I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago, Mitch Daniels, our little Napoleon governor, leased it to the Spaniards.
Oh, really?
From Spain. Now, I've worked up there, a heavy equipment operator, and it's quite a adventure dealing with these people. And I drive it occasionally, and it's really not getting any better. I mean, they have made a few improvements, but...
So now the people who are sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive aren't even Paris Hilton and Mitt Romney. They're somebody in Barcelona.
Well, yeah.
Amazing.
And not only that, you know, it was a $2 billion lease for 75 years, and I believe most of the money went down to Indy, where we just recently had a Super Bowl, coincidentally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's where most of the money came, so they could build it all up.
Amazing. Don, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. Andy, watching us on Free Speech TV in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to let you know that the Republicans in the Missouri State Senate have just put forward a bill to make Interstate 70 between Kansas City and St. Louis a toll road.
Oh, geez. What
they want to do is they want to charge us $2 billion to add one more lane in each direction because it is a very heavily traveled road.
Right. Right. Amazing.
Now, the one thing that I would say is Grover Norquist always wanted to shrink federal government down to where they could drown it in a bathtub.
Right.
I'm thinking what we should do is we should bust up these corporations so they don't own our government.
Yeah, there you go. And we need to pass a constitutional amendment that says that they don't have the rights of people, so they can't influence our government, whether they own it or not. But excellent point, Andy. Thank you for sharing that with us. Kind of grim news. It's really quite amazing. Tammy, listening on KNYO in Fort Bragg, California. Hey, Tammy, what's up? We have a minute to the break, by the way.
Okay. I wanted to let you know that I'm in a population of 7,500 in our little coastal town in Mendocino County, and we broadcast, this radio station broadcasts from a shack in the woods with an ATV antenna on a redwood tree.
Cool.
And that's how we get you here.
Well, thank you.
I have done a number of things. I've joined the Move to Amend via the Internet and various peace groups online for the larger perspective. And then locally, I've joined Occupy Mendo and groups that are into sustainable living. Koch Brothers purchased like a third of our city in 2005, so there's a lot going on with that. But I get bogged down with I start thinking about the power down, Richard Heinberg's power down theory, which I really am a believer of, and trying to prioritize these actions on, you know, what things I think I should put my energy into.
Right.
So I was wondering if you had some kind of a suggestion as far as...
My advice is really simple, Tammy. Find what you're passionate about and throw yourself into it. You know, whether it's if you're passionate about the rights of animals, join PETA. If you're passionate about the commons, join Common Cause or one of the organizations that's working on the commons. If you're passionate about politics, join PD America, ProgressiveDemocratsOfAmerica.org, something like that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I always get interrupted by that guy. But whatever you're passionate about, that's what you need to throw yourself into, because you'll do so much better and have so much more impact. Thank you for the call, Tim.
Well, I saw a crying, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again.
We've been talking about roads. We've been talking about whether Democrats should vote in the Republican primary for or against Mitt Romney in Michigan. I don't think they should. I think they should stay out of it and let the Republicans just deal with it. But, you know, who knows? We'll see how this is all shaking out. Mitt Romney's chances of winning are dropping on Intrade.com and in our road system. Well, anyway, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book. And Victoria, what's up? What's going on? I see you're in the White House again.
I'm in the White House again. Yes, indeed. I just came from the White House press briefing, which some of the talk was about President Obama's speech earlier today to the United Auto Workers Convention here in Washington, D.C., where he gave a rousing speech to 1,700 auto workers, and he was having a good time.
We have here's just one clip from that, just FYI.
I keep on hearing these same folks talk about values all the time. You want to talk about values? Hard work, that's a value. Looking out for one another, that's a value. The idea that we're all in it together and I'm my brother's keeper and sister's keeper, that's a value.
How about that, Victoria?
Oh yeah. There was quite a lot of that. Once he got into it, that was sort of in the second half of the speech. He really, really got into it, straight after that, that is a value. He goes on, but they're still talking about you as if you're some greedy special interest that needs to be beaten. Since when are hardworking men and women special interests?
Right.
Since when is the idea that we look out for each other a bad thing? To borrow a line from our old friend Ted Kennedy, what is it about good working men and women they find so offensive?
Right. This is an incredible example of President Barack Obama taking names and kicking ass, as the old phrase
really
goes.
He did. And yeah. He very strongly defended the auto bailout, and he took a number of shots at certain Republicans. He didn't name them, but he talked about one person who said, some even said we should let Detroit go bankrupt.
Yeah, which was the title of Mitt Romney's 2008 op-ed piece.
Yeah, good figure. but he talked about they many, many times. This was a rousing speech. I tweeted that this was a campaign speech, and
sure.
I don't see anything wrong with that. And yet, astonishingly, the front row at the briefing spent their time, their questions, their precious questions on their $300,000, $400,000 salaries, asking about whether it was a campaign speech and trying to nail Carney on that rather than asking about substance, because that matters to them.
Wow.
About whether it was or wasn't a campaign speech.
It's a sad commentary on the state of our media.
It's like, why does anybody care whether it was or it wasn't?
It's a campaign year. What do you expect? Of course, you know, the candidates, and he is a candidate, are going to speak in a way that is going to help them get elected. What, do you think he's an idiot? He's going to stand up there and go, yeah, everything's fine, just ignore me, I think I'm going to go take a nap.
I mean, he talked about five more years, and then the crowd started to chant four more years, and he just stood there and smiled that smile at his. It was clearly, that's what it was, and everybody knew that's what it was. I mean, why is the man going to fundraisers? Hello?
Yeah.
It's very odd. So that was going on there. Meantime, over at the Supreme Court today, corporations and human rights groups are squaring off in a fight over whether foreign victims of war crimes, killings, and other atrocities can haul multinational companies into American courts to try and prove they were complicit in the abuses and should pay damages.
Right. This is under the Alien Tort Act, which goes back to the early 18th century.
It's 1789.
Or early 19th century. Yeah.
Yeah.
1799. Okay, late 18th century.
1789, yeah. French Revolution time. Yeah. And they're hearing the arguments today over the reach of the Alien Tort Statute and also a 20-year-old law that allows victims of torture to pursue civil lawsuits against the responsible individuals. Mm. And it's going to be extremely complex and really very iffy to see whether they can do this. As to whether the companies themselves, like Royal Dutch Petroleum, Shell's, the U.S. subsidiary of Shell, who had people working for it in Nigeria, for example, in this particular case, to clamp down on protests against oil and gas exploration and development, whether the company itself can be sued.
Right. Because they got a bunch of these. Ken Sawahara, how do you pronounce his last name?
I believe her name is, I don't want to get it wrong, actually.
Yeah,
I don't
no, that's okay. I'm talking about the group of people who got hung.
I think her name is pronounced.
Yeah, who were hung by, by the Nigerian government at the behest of Shell Oil, or at least that was the story at the time. And what I find interesting is, in Citizens United, the Supreme Court reversed a law that was passed during the Teddy Roosevelt administration in 1907, the Tillman Act. Are they now going to go back and reverse a law that was passed in 1798, which would have been the John Adams administration? I mean, is that how radical the Supreme Court is, that they're going to go back before John Marshall and reverse a law?
I think they're capable of it.
I think they are, too. I think these guys are, they're trying to remake America in some bizarre libertarian image that they have that is being directed by the Koch brothers funded Heritage Foundation that employs Clarence Thomas's wife. And well, enough of my rant. We have a minute left. You have more news.
Well, whatever it is, you won't be seeing it in the Supreme Court anytime soon. You may remember I gave an optimistic report recently because a bill to have cameras in the Supreme Court got through the Judiciary Committee in the Senate this month. Well, it hasn't been scheduled for a floor vote, and it's stuck. And it doesn't look like it's going to come up because leadership is getting leery about telling the judicial branch how to do its business.
But the Constitution says that they should. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations established by Congress.
They are getting sort of nervous about it. They're weighing the wisdom of it, and it's that no one will say anything. If you go to leadership, they're referring you to Judiciary Committee Chairman Lamar Smith of Texas. He's refusing to answer any questions.
Oh, this is in the House.
This is in the House. But the Senate's not talking either.
Amazing. Well, this is something that our listeners should be calling their members of the House or Senate and saying, we want cameras in the Supreme Court, and you guys can pass a law for it. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Up next, are our nuclear reactors falling apart, plus President Obama's speech today?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Back in the 1970s, I carried on a course. This was back when you type letter on an IBM Selectric typewriter. I remember. In fact, I remember when they came out with the little, you can white out, the key. Anyhow, I had this letter correspondence with a fellow by the name of John Goffman, who at the time was the head of the Union of Concerned Scientists, about nuclear safety, nuclear power. I lived in Michigan. We'd almost seen Fermi go down in Detroit. I used to vacation when I was a little kid. I mean, like when I was 5 and 6 up in Charlevoix, there was this hot water stream that came out of the nuclear reactor in Charlevoix. My brothers and I used to sit in the warm water and think that was so cool as it went down into Lake Michigan. We later learned that it was a radioactive water leak, and they shut down the nuclear power plant. I probably glow in the dark. I don't know. But the Union of Concerned Scientists is still doing brilliant work. And to this day, I mean, that was back in the 60s and 70s. And now here, the director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists Global Security Program, a nuclear engineer, and the author of the report released today, titled U.S. Nuclear Power Plants, the NRC and Nuclear Power Plant Safety in 2011, Living on Borrowed Time. David Lockbaum is with us. You can read all about it, by the way, at UCS, as in Union Concerned Scientists, USA.org. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm honored to have you with us. You said March 11 marks the one-year anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. That's just almost 2 weeks from now or thereabouts. What have we learned since then, and what do we know about America's vulnerability to Fukushima-like events?
Well, I think the events at Fukushima, as the previous events at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and Fermi 1 that you mentioned, showed us that nuclear disasters can occur. Fortunately, they're pretty rare, but they do, in fact, do occur from time to time. I think what our last two annual reports have shown is that we've had a number of near misses, perhaps more near misses than we should have had. And if we don't learn the lessons from those near misses, we're going to tolerate pre-existing conditions that can make it more likely for the next nuclear disaster to occur.
And, for example?
Well, last year there were 15 near misses at U.S. nuclear power reactors. That's an average of more than one a month.
Now, what do you describe as a near miss? What is a near miss?
A near miss is when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission sends out a team to investigate why an event occurred or why a discovery was made. They send out these teams when that discovery or that event increases the risk of core damage or meltdown by a factor of 10 or more.
Wow.
So it's not an arbitrary decision of ours. None of those events led to that outcome, but too many steps were taken down that path. We need to reduce the number of times we start down that road and also limit how many steps we take along it.
John Goffman once wrote to me, actually, that there is no such thing as a safe level of nuclear exposure, radiation exposure, and that it's, my recollection, it's been a lot of years, but I think he said something like, you know, safe nuclear power is an oxymoron. Are those sentiments with which you would agree?
I would agree with the first. There is no safe level of radiation. What you can do is try to minimize your exposure or workers or public exposure so that that risk is no greater than from other hazards that we face in life. The second phase is there's also no free lunch. There is no damage-free or risk-free way of producing electricity. My view is that if we manage the risk of nuclear power appropriately, we can manage that risk down to an acceptably low level. We're not advocating taking nuclear power plants out of the game or off the table, but just enforcing the regulations so that their risks are no larger than they need to be.
Yeah, I would respectfully, strongly disagree with that. I mean, just the poisoning of communities from uranium mining tailings, and the questions about what we're going to do with waste. And this whole issue, particularly when we've got so much sunlight falling on the United States, we could easily power our entire country with solar, and the technologies to the point where it's cheaper than anything is cheaper than nuclear. I mean, you know, without Price Anderson, without all of us subsidizing the nuclear industry, it wouldn't even exist.
Well, I think you point to something. It was about 50 years ago where anybody on the planet first used nuclear power to generate electricity. It was in December of 1952 in Arco, Idaho. And in that time, we've gone from 4 light bulbs in Idaho to more than 400 nuclear power plants worldwide. If we look forward the next generation or two, we believe that renewable technologies and energy efficiency can make the same gains that nuclear power did in the past two generations. If so, then nuclear power wouldn't be needed, as you know, coal-fired plants wouldn't be needed either.
Right.
So that would be our future if we could divine a path. But
right.
In the interim, we want the existing plants to be made as safe as possible.
Well, I understand that, and I understand you're taking a somewhat centrist viewpoint. It probably, if nothing else, works better when you're presenting information to politicians, not to have a chip on your shoulder like I do. Isn't the biggest deal here, though, that our infrastructure is falling apart all across the United States, and our nuclear plants are part of that infrastructure that really isn't getting the maintenance that it needs, and that nuclear plants, because they're exposed, or at least parts of them are exposed to so much radiation, tend to fall apart faster than things like hospitals and schools and apartment buildings, which in many cases in the United States are, you know, 60, 80, 100 years old. A nuclear power plant probably couldn't do that.
You're right. I mean, if you look at today's 104 nuclear power reactors, they're all approaching, if not already in, the wear-out phase of their life where the risk goes up. There's some talk about building new nuclear power plants, but that puts new plants down in the break-in phase or the infant mortality phase where the risk is also higher. You can't put a nuclear power plant down in middle life where its risk is lowest. Recognizing that, what we think is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission needs to be at an aggressive nuclear comp on the beat, not this Laurel and Hardy Sergeant Schultz guy that we've got at the moment.
Yeah. Is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, are all of the members appointed by the president? I mean, what's the composition of that?
There are five presidentially appointed commissioners, no more than three can come from the same political party. So we have roughly an even split. It's 3-2. I can't remember if there's more Republicans or more Democrats, but they serve five-year terms on a rotating basis so that every June 30th, one of the commissioner seats is up for renewal. The rest of the staff of 4,000 people are government employees who work for those presidential appointees.
To what extent has the NRC experienced regulatory capture where the nuclear industry, everybody in the NRC knows that they've got a really, really good job with the industry after they leave if they just make the right decisions, that kind of thing. We see this in the Defense Department big time, the revolving door. You see it in the Department of Agriculture and in those areas where that have regulatory oversight. You see it in the FDA in those areas that have regulatory oversight. To what extent has that happened in the NRC?
I'm probably not the best person to throw that stone because I went through that revolving door myself. I went to work for the NRC 3 years ago and then came back to UCS. So I'm not the best. But what we have seen is that the United States Congress sets the NRC's budget every year.
Right.
And the United States Congress gets a lot of money from political action committees, the power companies, and that congressional control. In 1998, Congress told the NRC to stop enforcing regulations or we'll cut your budget by 40%.
Really?
Yeah.
Stop enforcing existing regulations?
Yep. Or we'll cut your budget by 40%.
What year was this? Congress said this to them?
June 4th, 1998.
Wow.
I remember that very vividly because that's the day the NRC stopped even pretending to be an aggressive regulator.
Now, was that, which body of Congress said that and which party was in control, if you don't mind my asking?
It was the Republicans were in control. It was the Senate Appropriations Committee headed by then Senator Domenici from New Mexico. And he's written a book since then after he retired from the Senate. The nuclear industry calls him St. Pete.
St. Pete. Oh, my. Okay. David Lockbaum, the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org is their website. I strongly commend it to you. Check it out. David, the Director of Nuclear Safety Project and an actual nuclear engineer. David, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks for this great report. The NRC and Nuclear Power Safety in 2011, Living on Borrowed Time.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, why don't we just do some smart stuff? Actually, why don't we hear some smart stuff? President Obama up next. Some clips of it. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And just notice the contrast here. This is a mashup that the Center for American Progress put together over at the Think Progress blog. Mitt Romney's 10 most out-of-touch comments. Here he is.
Being someone who seems woefully out of touch.
Today he's out of touch with reality.
He's out of touch.
Out of touch.
I know what it's like to worry whether you're going to get fired. There were a couple of times I wondered whether I was going to get a pink slip.
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on... Of course they are.
Rick, I'll tell you what. $10,000? $10,000 bet?
I get speaker's fees from time to time, but not very much.
But I have some great friends that are NASCAR team owners.
I drive a Mustang and a Chevy pickup truck. Ann drives a couple of Cadillacs, actually.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs repair, I'll fix it.
I think I should also tell my story. I'm also unemployed.
I like being able to fire people who provide services to me.
Yeah, okay. So that's candidate A. Here are a couple of clips from candidate B speaking today to the United Auto Workers.
The same folks who said if we went forward with our plan to rescue Detroit, you can kiss the American automotive industry goodbye. Now they're saying we were right all along.
And here's another one.
Or you've got folks saying, well, the real problem is what we really disagreed with was the workers. They all made it out like bandits. The saving the auto industry was just about paying back the unions. Really? I mean, even by the standards of this town, that's a load of you know what.
And This is Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, in full taking names and kicking patootie mode here. Here's another clip.
About 700,000 retirees had to make sacrifices on their health care benefits that they had earned. A lot of you saw hours reduced or pay or wages scaled back. You gave up some of your rights as workers. Promises were made to you over the years that you gave up for the sake and survival of this industry, its workers, their families. Right. You want to talk about sacrifice? You made sacrifices.
Yeah, and they did. But, you know, you're not going to hear that on right-wing talk radio. You're not going to hear that coming from the Republicans. What you're going to hear is, bailout, trying to bail out, you know, conflate bailing out Detroit with bailing out the banksters, which is what George W. Bush did, which they always neglect to point out when they talk about the bank bailout, that was George W. Bush. Remember Henry Paulson standing there shaking with his hands? You know, we need this three-page sheet, $800 billion, to give it to the banksters, no questions asked, so that Goldman Sachs will not go out of business when AIG goes down and can't pay their counterparty claims. Got another clip for me, Jacob. Here's the president again.
I keep on hearing these same folks talk about values all the time. You want to talk about values? Hard work, that's a value. Looking out for one another, that's a value. The idea that we're all in it together and I'm my brother's keeper and sister's keeper, that's a value.
There you go. So today in Michigan, and let me just refresh my InTrade page here today and see. InTrade, by the way, is this betting site that's based out of Ireland where it's legal to bet on anything. And people around the world, all around the world, go into InTrade and bet on, you know, pretty much anything you can imagine you can bet on over at InTrade. And the top bet right now is Mitt Romney to win the 2012 Michigan primary. And it's very interesting. It was at 58% earlier today, went down to 54%. Now it's at 56.8%. Rick Santorum down to 45%. Mitt Romney would be the Republican nominee. That was a 75% yesterday. It's at 72.3% now. Fascinating. We'll see where this goes. But here's the robocall that Rick Santorum – actually, here's Rick – first of all, here's the robocall that Rick Santorum – and do you have the whole thing, Jacob? Do you have the whole – you just have the piece of it? Okay. Here's the robocall, Rick Santorum's robocall, that they're calling to Democrats in Michigan.
Romney supported the bailouts for his Wall Street billionaire buddies, but opposed the auto bailouts. On Tuesday, join Democrats who are going to send a loud message to Massachusetts' Mitt Romney by voting for Rick Santorum for president.
And then at the end it says, brought to you by Democrats in Michigan, and paid for by the Rick Santorum campaign for president. So that call is going out to registered Democrats all across the state. Meanwhile, here's Rick Santorum being clip number three, being rather defensive about this.
I mean, when he runs a robocall of my voice from 4 years ago saying good things about him, that's not a low moment.
Yeah, but this is. Well, we'll see. And as I've said, my personal opinion of this is, if you're a Democrat in Michigan, I would not vote for either Mitt Romney or Rick Santorum. I would hold my values rather than try to play a dirty political game. Even though there's some Republicans, even though Rick Santorum is asking you to do that. So anyhow, Stanley in Tyler, Texas. Hey, Stanley, a minute to the break. What's up?
Howdy, Tom.
Hey, Stanley.
Just a second here while I get y'all speaker. Old cat to eat. He's getting old, up there in age. I just wanted to touch base quickly with a couple of items.
Pick one. We got about three quarters of a minute.
Okay. You know, we were talking about the toll roads.
Yeah.
I mean, in Texas, when they were trying to do this Trans-Texas Corridor,
mm-hmm.
they wanted to make a toll road.
Mm-hmm.
And on the side roads that went the same direction, the company did not want there to be any maintenance done on these old roads.
Wow.
So obviously they don't want any competition.
Yeah. So they went and after then, they lobbied the state for that?
Oh yeah, that was part of the deal.
that they were going to be, they were going to get the toll roads, that was going to be part of the deal.
And everything else gets to be potholes. Amazing. Stanley, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Tyler, Texas. We'll be right back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, more of your calls and the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word, ugly. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very thalipthoriciously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Occupy DC. The DC branch of the Occupy movement helped a Maryland resident facing eviction keep her home. A group of 50 DC occupiers protested outside of Fannie Mae's offices in downtown Washington on behalf of Bertina Jones, a woman facing eviction even though she was still making her mortgage payments. After hearing about Jones's story about from Maryland Legal Aid, the occupiers took action, marching in a circle around her outside the Freddie Mac building, chanting, "Housing is a right." Apparently, this all influenced Freddie Mac just enough to come up with a new mortgage payment plan for Jones. Occupy members across the country have been looking for a purpose after being evicted from their local encampments. It's great to see that those in D.C. decided to fight for Ms. Jones. Hopefully they and the rest of the movement can keep up the good work and help to further influence the change that this country so desperately needs. The bad. Arizona State Representative Michelle Ugenti. Last week, an Arizona State House committee approved a bill that would require even poverty-stricken students to pay a minimum of $2,000 a year to attend public universities in Arizona. Nearly 100 state college students showed up at the committee's hearing to voice their concerns over the increased tuition. One of the students argued that the increasing tuition would make it hard for poor students to achieve higher education, to which State Representative Ugenti replied, "Welcome to life." Government officials like Representative Ugenti should be working to help students of low-income families be able to afford the rising costs of higher education and not be dismissing or ridiculing their misfortunes as a fact of life, as she so nonchalantly did. And the very, very ugly Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Walker and the Wisconsin State Legislature are very close to repealing a portion of the state law that prohibits employers from discriminating on the basis of age, race, color, disability, and other personal traits. As it stands now, if a worker does discriminate against an employee, that individual can hold the employer accountable in state court rather than going directly to federal court. However, if the repeal becomes law, victims of discrimination will no longer be able to challenge the actions of their employer in state court. This is seemingly one of the most egregious actions by Governor Walker and his legislative friends in their war on workers' rights. There is nothing more fundamental in a democratic society than guaranteeing that workers are free from discrimination in the workplace, and trying to do away with this protection is very, very ugly. Boy, that's very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Of course, hey, it's Scott Walker. I mean, what do you expect? CC in Tegosa Springs, Colorado. Hey, CC, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just have a comment about nuclear power. I'll believe that it's safe when they build a plant in a gated community and the homeowners association maintains it. Thank you.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. You're spot on. Spot on. Put it in the gated community where the CEOs for the healthcare companies live. Who make literally, in the case of United Healthcare, two of them in a row made over $1 billion a year. Or not a year, but in total. Glenn in Torrance, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Not much. I just wanted to comment on a few things on the nuclear power versus solar. Firstly, in terms of solar, even if we had the capacity right now to put the entire grid on solar, we wouldn't have the battery capability to hold the charge long enough to make it useful.
At this moment, but you don't have to use batteries. You can use electrolysis to convert water to hydrogen and oxygen, store that hydrogen, and then use fuel cells to convert the hydrogen back to electricity. And you know, they're getting quite efficient, actually.
yeah, it's getting a lot better in the last couple of years. But again, you've got a problem with deployment and how are we, and what are the regulations to sure. preventing it from happening. The second part is that just yesterday, Kickstarter got liquid fuel thorium reactor plants. They got the funding to go do that now. And that's really interesting.
Which is theoretically less likely to have meltdowns or explosions, but it does still produce nuclear waste.
Although thorium is one of the byproducts of the current reactors using uranium, and thorium's right. a lot easier to get a hold of, and it's not as bad. They also talk, interestingly enough, about the radon gas that's released when people are coal mining and fracking,
right.
which is not regulated at all, and we don't even know how much is being released into the atmosphere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And but although let's keep in mind, the largest emitter of thorium of radon gas is uranium mining. Because the
absolutely.
Uranium tailings,
yeah.
not only do they produce radon, but they produce radionuclides that decay into radon.
Yeah, and it's a good point. But, you know, there's a bunch of different ways we need to approach this problem and be looking for solutions. That's
yeah.
pretty much what it is.
Yep. I do not disagree with you at all. Thank you, Glenn, for the call. Maddie in Pasadena listening on K-Talk. Hey, Maddie, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. It's so good to talk to you. Just wanted to give you a couple things here. My group, Occupy Democracy Pasadena, has is working with Occupy in general for a couple events tomorrow. You know about the nationwide Occupy. Tomorrow, have you heard of that?
The nationwide, you broke up a little bit. What was the nationwide
oh,
what?
I'm sorry. Occupy Portland is calling for a nationwide against ALEC.
Oh, yeah, against the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers-funded thing that makes all these wackadoodle laws like the voter ID laws that they pass out to the states.
Exactly. I think that's the thing. It'd be great if you could start really hitting home on that because people are not even aware.
We have. In fact, we had one of the people from that Occupy movement on as a guest. We have been talking about that. And you're right. We need to keep beating that drum. Maddie, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Jim in Laguna Beach, California, listening on AM 1150. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Good morning. Thank you for a great program. I wish I could talk about San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant. I'm just a couple of miles from there. And I've been watching there's a lot of community effort going into discussion about that because it's up for renewal soon and it's past its expiration date and we're pretty concerned about it.
Yeah.
But you've talked this morning about people finding what they're passionate about and you've talked a lot in the past about the importance of the commons, and you've talked about the Occupy movement and how it might evolve and what it might become. And I've got a project I thought you might be interested in knowing about up in Oakland.
Okay.
In response to the Oakland mess up there, a group of young photographers and rabble-rousers gathered protester portraits and statements over the last few weeks, and they're mounting them around town in black-and-white images, big, some 25-foot tall. It's part of a global project by the artist J.R., who's helped with 9,000 of these being mounted all over the world, and it has to do with protest and identity and the commons. And the group of photographers up in Oakland actually were kind of on the periphery of the protests and were watching what was going on. And saw how the thing was being spun, too. So they decided to do this. It's called Inside Out Occupy Oakland. And Occupy Oakland in a different way, through art and in a peaceful
way. That's great.
It is. And on their WordPress website, Inside Out Occupy Oakland, you can see images. They just started going up this last weekend. Really interesting, and on that website you can get to the Facebook page or even the Kickstarter page. But there's more to come, and you know it's kind of an urban exhibition around Oakland, a different way of occupying.
That's marvelous. Jim, thank you for sharing that with us and for the heads up for all of our listeners in that area. Carol in Marquette, Michigan. Hey, Carol, how's everything going way up north?
Oh, not too bad. I can see Canada from my front door here on the shore of Lake Superior. I was calling to make a comment about the going to the primaries, the Republican primaries. I'm definitely not a Republican. I'm an independent. And, of course, I got some of those obnoxious robocalls the last few days like everyone else in the state has been getting. But I'm going to go in and vote today, but I'm going to vote for Buddy Romer. just because, just on the principle of the fact that he does not take corporate money. I figure I'll go, you know, this is my way of protesting the corporate money in the elections.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any chance of winning, but.
That's a great protest vote. That's a great suggestion. Let me officially on the air right here, right now, amend my own admonition to Democrats not to vote in the Republican primary, even though I had Buddy Romer on this program, and he and I mixed it up about Social Security. He wants to turn Social Security over to Wall Street. He wants to privatize
right.
it. And when I called him out on that, he got quite upset because most of the people who he's been getting lots of love from on the left have no idea what his actual policy positions are. They just know that he doesn't like, you know, money and particularly corporate money, but billionaire money in elections. And we all agree with him on that. And he wanted to keep it to the things that we agreed on. But still, I think that that's a great protest vote. And it's a great way of saying to the Republican Party, enough already. You know, we're ready for Citizens United or whatever, that we at least agree with Buddy Romer on this, that he may be nuts about Social Security and Medicare and the commons, but he is certainly right about money and politics.
Well, so, thanks, Tom.
Yeah,
good
well said.
This afternoon.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. Lanny in Sharon, Georgia. Hey, Lanny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. It's funny, when you said my name, you went, and the only reason I knew is there's only one Sharon, Georgia in the world.
Ah. Oh, hey, Lanny, okay. I missed a time cue. Can you hold on for just a second, and I'll pick your call up on the other side of the break?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Hold on just a minute here. We have to go to a break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program, and the Michigan primary, of course, the Arizona primary is going on today, too, although it seems like Mitt's got that one sewn up. But the Michigan one, his home state, in great contest.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if I was a Michigander, and I grew up there, spent my first 27 years there, I was born there, if I was still a registered voter there, I'd seriously think about voting for Buddy Romer today.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Greg in Troy, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. As a Michiganian, one Michiganian to another one, you were talking about the commons. And I think one of the commons here that we overlook in Michigan are the Great Lakes. Not just Michigan, but all these surrounding states. As a resident here for 50-plus years, I have paid a lot of taxes, just like everyone else has, to help maintain the Great Lakes through our Department of Natural Resources and various other agencies. And the lakes right now have been, well, not right now, but for a long time, have been exploited by commercial interest, none of the profits of which come back to the state, to the residents, the taxpayers. And right now there's at least two bottling companies, and you're probably aware of some more, that are taking water from the lakes themselves and also some from inland sources such as springs, and bottling it up, shipping it off, and the residents here are getting absolutely no benefit from that whatsoever. And I was wondering if the people in Michigan and Wisconsin and some of the other states that pay so much to maintain these lakes could ever maybe get some type of revenue sharing going on here.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, Sarah Palin looked at this up in Alaska and said, we got a lot of oil and these oil companies want the oil. Let's cut a check for $2,000 to everybody who lives in Alaska. You know, I mean, it wasn't her who invented the Alaska Permanent Fund. It went way back before her. But you're talking about the internalization of profits, the externalization of costs by private corporations. And yeah, they should be paying for that. And that's a great topic to be bringing up. By the way, you called yourself a Michiganian. I was born in Grand Rapids. I grew up in Lansing. I left the state when I was 27 in 78. And I always called myself a Michigander. When did it change?
Well, there's two groups. There's the Michiganders and the Michiganians. I fall in the Don't ask me how you differentiate one from the other or why there's two different ways of saying it. But
uh-huh.
I've seen it in print, both ways, and I hear people saying it both ways.
So interesting. Okay, I kind of like Michigander. Yeah. I envision, you know, I think of the geese flying over the state every spring and fall. But anyhow, Greg, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WDTW. I appreciate it. Sydney in Diamond Bar, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Sydney, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling in reference to the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
It seems to have faded a bit.
I don't think so. I think this
months.
Is a hiatus.
Okay, well, that's fine.
Bad weather and shutdown occupations, but the people have not lost their commitment.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. This call is in reference to a call to action for a march from the Santa Monica Pier in California to Wall Street.
Wow, that's a long
May
one.
I give the name of may I give a name of a website that people can go to?
Certainly.
To find the website is OccupyCoastToCoast.com. One word, OccupyCoastToCoast.com.
Two is
T-O.
Right. Occupy
so
Coast to Coast.
With one T, there's two T's strung together in the middle there.
Yeah, got it.
And any information can be sent to Sydney. Any inquiries can be sent to Sydney at OccupyCoastToCoast.com.
Okay. Sydney, thanks. Thank you very much. Excellent plug, and hopefully a whole lot of people will get over and check it out. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening to K-Talk. Prof in Rock Hill, North Carolina, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Prof, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm doing great.
Good. Ditto.
I just wanted to tell you what happened. You know, I'm with Occupy Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, of course, kicked out and everything like everybody else. But we went ahead and set up us a little projector, and we were projecting images on the walls, you know, and all that. And we had a great response. Everybody was really enjoying it. We set it up in a baby carriage, so we were on the sidewalk. We were in public space. We weren't, you know, we didn't shine it in any windows, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally came around, the cops, after we were leaving. We had a bunch of people watching it, but we, you know, the crowd went away, and so we decided to leave, and the cops came up and took our projector, and they said that we were projecting, advertising material on the wall.
Right.
They kept the projector as evidence.
Oh, gee. I'm sorry to hear that, Prof. I mean, this is the thing. When you speak truth to power, when you speak to the establishment, the establishment very often speaks back, and sometimes they speak back by, you know, putting their foot on your head. And
right.
the only response is to just keep on speaking. It's not to respond.
That's what I wanted to tell you about what okay. we're speaking about now.
Okay.
What I'm thinking is the people, the 99% of the world, must unite around a goal, something we can all agree on.
Right.
And one of the things I found that we can all agree on is that we want our money back. The words being, give it back.
You're talking about the $7 trillion that has vanished since 2007
exactly.
out of the American middle class?
Exactly. We want a 200% ill-gotten gains tax. Either you're with us or you're misinformed. All the 99% will agree that they want fraud paid back. Everyone I talked to did.
Yeah.
Talk to your politicians. They're willing to push for, or are they willing to push for a 200% ill-gotten gains tax?
Well, here's the one problem. With the exception of seven people, all the Republicans in Congress have signed an oath to multimillionaire K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist that supersedes,
right.
in their opinion, their oath to the Constitution, their oath of office. And
right.
therefore, they
right.
will not
I
vote for
that
tax increase that you're talking about, even
well,
though the Constitution says that's their job.
This is an ill-gotten gains tax. In other words, if you stole money, you either got to pay it back or it's ill-gotten gains, and you can pay 200%.
Yeah, I'm with you, Prof. I'm totally with you. It's just, you know, it's going to take, we're going to get those Republicans out of the House of Representatives. Coming up tomorrow, big oil is still pushing the Keystone Pipeline. Gas prices are on the rise. Who or what is behind it? What does that mean for the elections? I'll confront Dustin Stockman of TeaParty.net, who thinks that this is the left's dream come true. High gas prices. I don't think so. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.